You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. Today, I don't really have a specific story that I'm going to be covering, but since yesterday I was talking about what I thought would be the issues, the political issues that would be the hot topics for November, I want to talk about the problem, for example, independents have. I was talking to a gentleman who's really going for an engineering degree, but his job is in maintenance. And had a long conversation with him. And that's the reason I don't have a specific topic. But I was looking up, we got into a discussion. And I said, the problem is, if you want to convince people to vote for you, it's not enough to be critical of your opponent. Because what I, for example, as a voter, want to know is, what do you stand for? What are your principles? What is your political philosophy? What are your thoughts on various issues? In other words, what is your agenda or program? In other words, you don't win sports games, for example, by having a terrific defense. You need an offense. You need to stand for something. You need a positive message. And if you have a positive message and can relate to your political base, and your thoughts and views resonate with that political base, you will most likely be elected to office. There's one big problem, though. If you look at incumbency success ratios, for example, in the House of Representatives as well as the Senate, incumbents, and it varies from year to year, usually win 90 to 95% of the time. In other words, you have what's called the incumbency advantage. And that's hard to overcome because you can be a person of integrity, principle, have great ideas. You can even be a great communicator and have a great message. But if the voters never hear that message, your chances of getting elected for any office are very small. It doesn't mean it's impossible, and you might get lucky by being in the arena and get some campaign contributions. And if they're well spent and you get your message out, you can be elected to office. But it's not easy because you're always going to be up against that incumbency advantage. And it doesn't make any difference whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. If you're running against an incumbent, it's going to be an uphill battle. Now, after saying that, there's another trend, and it's an important trend, and that is the fact that more and more people have become totally disgusted with both political parties. They have walked away either from the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. And the reason is quite clear. Why, at one time, either party represented their views and normally got their vote, over time, and usually we're talking decades, both parties have changed. Both parties, as far as I'm concerned, have moved further and further and further to the left, to the extent that you now have literally no conservative or libertarian Democrats at all. So very few conservatives, if their political philosophy is conservatism, whether it's a fiscal conservative or a defense conservative or a social conservative, and there are various types of conservatives. Probably the major category is a traditional conservative. Or if you're a libertarian, or I prefer a classical liberal, you would have to look very hard to find anyone in the Democratic Party that has that political philosophy today. I'm sure there's probably one or two, but I'm totally unaware of them. I haven't looked. I haven't researched it. That was not the case when I was in high school or college or graduate school, or even when I was in the Air Force. There were Democrats that were conservative and some were libertarian. Most people will vote the political party that their parents voted for. And that's important, too. So incumbents, not only do they have the advantage of being elected and have a statistically the odds are strongly in their favor, but you have this habit of what whoever your parents voted for or your family voted for, you tend to vote that same political affiliation. Just an example, my parents, both sides of my family, were solid Democrats. Solid Democrats. They wouldn't consider voting for a Republican. They would say, that's the party of the rich. That's the party of the rich. They're not our kind of people. Now, I'm not today a Republican or Democrat. Like many millions of, and really tens of millions of Americans, I got, let's say, wise. I started to pay a little bit more attention because, like most Americans, I had another life to live. And politics has kind of gone hot and cold. There have been periods of time where I'd focus in on it, and there are many years, in some cases over a decade, where I really didn't pay any attention to it. But I've always tried to the best I could, vote for the individual that comes closest to my own political philosophy. And that is one of classical liberalism, the belief in a limited government, a representative republic. Noted, I didn't say democracy. And for individuals that will truly preserve and protect the United States Constitution. Because the founding fathers were very much classical liberals. They believed in limited government. And for most of the United States history, up until around 1930 or 1929, the federal government was small, very small. How small? The last year Calvin Coolidge was president in 1929, the size of the federal government was 3%. Look it up. That was not necessarily unusual. The only time the size of the federal government was larger than that was in time of war. And the two major wars were the Civil War and World War II. But other than those, after the war, the debts were paid down and the size of the federal government shrank. And during that period was some of the most prosperous and high growth periods that the United States has experienced. So you need some context. To put it in context, the first year of the Obama administration, the size of the federal government hit 24% as measured against gross domestic product, real gross domestic product, which is the sale of goods and services, final goods and services. In other words, it was eight times what it was in 1929. So from 1929 to 2009, a period of 80 years, the size of the federal government grew by a multiplier of 8. Now, we've had some improvement since then. The last time I checked, the size of the federal government was between 20 and 21% of GDP. So that is some improvement. But that's still 7 times what it was back in 1929. We don't have limited government today. We don't. And that's why I think many Americans are voting with their feet. They're not leaving the country. They're leaving their political party, whether it's Democrat or Republican, because year in, year out, election after election after election, they look for candidates that they can identify with. And I'm not talking identity politics in terms of it, they're the same race or the same religion or ethnic background. What I mean is, do they have similar political philosophies? Do they have programs that they would agree with? And sad to say, I look at both parties today and objectively say we don't have a party of limited government anymore. Even the Republicans that say they're for limited government, whether they call themselves conservative or libertarian, at best will say we might get back to 18%. Now, 18% is a big improvement from where we're at today, but that's still six times what the size of the federal government was in 1929 and most of the time before that, except in times of war. And yes, I understand we've had wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's part of why the government got larger. But it's not the entire answer, because if you look at welfare programs, they have multiplied and multiplied. Today, for example, let me just go through some of the big ones if you're on welfare. And these are people that either are not working or working part-time, and it's not a permanent job. They're poor or low income. First, you have the earned income tax credit. That's a biggie, folks. And there's a lot of fraud in that program. You also have food stamps. You also have subsidies to pay for housing. And you have security income programs. You have disability income programs. And those are the big ones. But you have dozens of others, training programs. And today, the bottom 50% of the American people, in terms of their incomes, pay less than 3% of personal taxes, personal income taxes collected. The top 50% pays over 97%. And it's worse if you break it down by the top 1%, 10%, and 20%. Although the numbers have varied from year to year and they bounce around, ballpark figure of the top 1%, and these are people earning several hundred thousand a year, pay approximately 40% of all taxes, the top 1%. Now, I want to be fair, because I didn't have time to look up that. I would have given you the entire breakdown, the top 1%, 5%, 10%, 25%, 50%. I didn't have time because I'm doing other things. But you have a couple of things, and I want to be fair to the people that are in the bottom 50%. Does that mean they're not paying taxes? No, it doesn't. They're not paying income taxes, but what are they paying? They're paying for Social Security. And if you add both the employer and the employees, what the really don't fall for the fiction that the employee pays half and your employer pays the other half. Because when you're hired, the employer knows he has to pay Social Security taxes. And if you didn't have Social Security taxes, you would probably earn more. So any employer, and most of my clients were employers, I was a small business person, had to pay it all because I was self-employed, you have to pay over 15%. So I want to be fair to say it's not that they're not paying any taxes. They are paying Social Security, Medicare, disability taxes, so-called FICA or payroll taxes. But they also get benefits from it. It's very much a pay-as-you-go system. And that brings up the second thing. What's responsible for the growth in government? One is war. War is the leading cause of governments getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. It's the ratcheting up of the size of the federal government can be traced and has been traced to war after war after war, especially if you're the world superpower. The problem with that, it gets out of hand. It gets out of control. America, if you ask this leader, we're not an empire. I beg to differ. We are an empire. But you got to understand, that's not a good thing. Because empires require large military forces, Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, you name it. And when you compound that with wars, suddenly defense spending, even though it's being cut right now, becomes a burden. At one time, defense spending was a large percentage of the total budget of the United States. Not anymore. It's under 20%. It used to be over 20%, significantly over 20%. But what has gotten bigger? I've already given you have defense is about 19. If you add welfare and entitlement programs, roughly, and I'm doing this from memory, that's about 45%. So add defense, you're right around 64%. And if you add interest on the debt, and remember, it's getting bigger and bigger, and interest rates have been artificially manipulated downward, kept low by our central bank, the Federal Reserve. Today, it's about 6%. So defense, welfare, entitlements, and interest, those four major categories, account for over 70% of what is being spent today. Now, here's what you need to understand. I haven't mentioned the other departments other than defense, so-called discretionary spending, and that needs to be emphasized. But what percent of our spending needs to be financed by debt? It's about one-third. It has fluctuated. It got as high as 40%. Today, it's about one-third. In other words, we have a Congress today, and it doesn't matter whether it's the Republicans controlling the presidency in Congress or the Democrats controlling the presidency or Congress, or what you have today, gridlock, where the House is controlled by the Democratic Party and the Senate is controlled by the House is controlled by the Republican Party, the Senate is controlled by the Democratic Party, and the presidency by a Democrat president. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because they're running huge deficits. George Bush did it, George W. Bush did it, and so did Barack Obama. And I was going to look up, and I'll do it hopefully by next show. And if you want to, you can do this because I haven't published my notes, but I need to, before I get on this, if you're a new listener to the show, the way you listen to the show is to go to the companion blog, which is pronkpops.wordpress.com. That's pronkpops, pronkpops.wordpress.com. And if you go there at the very top, you'll have links to at least the last 60 show, the most recent shows. At the very bottom of that page, you'll have the complete portfolio of all my shows except for the first seven that have unfortunately been lost to posterity. It's not that they weren't good, it's just they were accidentally overridden. But in between, you will have today, probably around 9, 10 o'clock tonight, my complete notes for this show. And the theme is, what do you do if neither political party really reflects your political philosophy, really reflects your heart, your core beliefs, and you don't think either party has integrity? You think they've been corrupted, and they both have been corrupted big time. What do you do? So why it's important, I think, to notice the trend that more and more Americans consider themselves independents, do not want to be identified with either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, and I fall in that category. See, for many years, I did what most voters do. They try to match, and they might not articulate it this way or express it this way, my political philosophy with that of the candidate that came closest. And almost invariably, that meant I voted for a Republican. I didn't vote on whether they were Republican or Democrat, but I tried to see what each candidate stood for. And in United Kingdom, for example, you stand for office, and you have an agenda, and you express your views on that agenda. The problem I face, and many independents face today, is in many congressional districts, many Senate races, and local races, I don't like the candidates from either party, or have reservations about them. Some I like what I hear, but time and time again, they tend to get elected, and after 1, 2, 3 elections, what they talk is not what they walk, and actions speak louder than words. And some are very, very good at expressing themselves, but when you do some digging, find out that there's some inconsistency. I spoke of illegal immigration yesterday, and I recall, I think it was the 206, 208, I think it was the 206. They tend to blend after a while. Republicans were all for a double fence with a road in between that was well patrolled. I'm still for that. It's not enough building a double fence with a road in between. If you did just that, the illegal aliens would still break into the country. It's absolutely essential it be well patrolled and manned, and use technology such as sensors, cameras, drones, helicopters, regular patrols. That's the only way you're going to stop the surge of illegal aliens into the country. This border could be shut down in a day, a week max. And it was. When was it shut down? after the attacks of 9/11. It can be done and has been done, but that faded rather quickly. And today, the United States is being invaded, and has been invaded for the last 15 years by illegal aliens. Half the problem is the U.S.-Mexican border, but the other half of the problem are people that fly into the United States every day from many, many countries. Students, businessmen, tourists, have visas, have passports. They need medical or shot records, immunization, or have that, present their papers, get into the country, and then overstay. It's not just what's happening in the Mexican border. Now, I'm not going to spend much time on it other than this. Who do I vote for in either party that truly believes in the rule of law today? That truly believes that it's an invasion, and it is an invasion. It's not 11 million in the shadows. That's a bogus lie. That's the big lie. It's between 30 and 50 million. And if you don't believe me, go talk to the people that are patrolling the borders. Talk to people that mainly are retired because they can speak. Because what's happening is they're putting a muzzle on the people today that are working there, and they're trying to get the word out. And I heard this many years ago. They will tell you for everyone that they detain and turn around and return them. They're called turnarounds. They return them to where they came from, their country of origin, usually Mexico. For every one that they detain, 3 to 5, conservatively 3 to 5. They'll also say maybe it's 6 to 7 or 8. We don't know. Nobody really knows the exact number. But at least 3 to 5 get through and make it to Dallas, Fort Worth, Arlington, Houston, as well as cities across Texas, the Southwest, and in other states. And this has been going on for at least 15 years. Actually, I would say 20. But I'm not going to take the whole 20 years or 22 years. I'm just taking the more recent history. And let's take the minimum number first. Yes, 3 to 5. Make it to sanctuary cities wherever they are in the United States. And some of the leading states are New York, New Jersey, Illinois, California, Washington, Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, California. I don't think I hit all 10, but those are the major states where you have the most illegal aliens. What we're talking about is between 3 and 5 million year in, year out, made it to sanctuary cities. Of those 3 to 5 million, about 1 million of them return to their country of origin, primarily Mexico. But keep in mind, this is only half the problem. So if we look at the detainee numbers, and most of them, not all of them, were detainees that crossed from the Mexican-U.S. border. On the low side, you're looking somewhere between, the estimate is between 2 to 4 make it through and stay. So when you multiply that by 1 million, you're looking at between 2 and 4 million a year. And up until the Obama administration, the detainee numbers were about 1 million. Sometimes it was a little higher, sometimes a little lower. Now what you have today is a noticeable decline in detainees. It's not that they're not crossing, but their leadership and its political leadership from Washington has made it clear, not that they don't want no enforcement, they don't want vigorous enforcement. So you've seen a decline in detainees. But set that aside for a minute. Let's use the 2 million a year number for 15 years. That means at least 30 million have got into the country. 1 million went back, 2 million stayed, times 15, 30 million. Now, if it's the high end of a conservative number, namely it's 3 million, we're talking 45 million made it across the border and stayed, and 15 million went back. So I don't know what the exact number is, but it's not 11 million. Now, why is this important? Who do I vote for in the November elections that's truly strong on the immigration issue? There are people to vote for. It's not like there's nobody. That's not true. But literally, not every Democrat, but most Democrats have a terrible record regarding immigration. And unfortunately, a large percentage of Republicans are the same way. They're talking out of both sides of their mouths. Now, the reason I go on and on about this, I'm tired of hearing the lie that it's 11 million in the shadows. That 11 million comes from the Pew, Hispanic, what do they call it, Center, that's where the 11 million number comes from. They publish a number every year, and that's what the major media uses. Do they talk to the U.S. Border Patrol? Because if they did, it doesn't take a lot of effort. Reporters are doing it. That's what they're going to hear. What I'm saying is not my opinion. It's based on what I'm hearing from various reports from the U.S. Border Patrol, from the rank and file. They know what's going on. And what's different with what's happening in immigration today? Immigration has always been an issue throughout American history. But what's unique about the last 15 years? It's the numbers. It's the quantum leap in the numbers. And that's what I was having this conversation about. I said, for most of U.S. history, the average number of immigrants, and these are legal immigrants into the United States, it's about 250,000 a year. That was the average. Starting in the 80s, the 1990s, and continuing into this century, the numbers of legal immigrants went up. And for the last 10 years, it's been averaging over a million a year. Legal immigration. Now, why do I give you this number? Most Americans are not aware of that number. That's why I'm repeating it. You will not hear this on the news. The legal number. Forget about the illegal number for a minute. Now, why is it important? If you ask the man on the street, your average American, are you for immigration? What will they say? Yes, we are a nation of immigrants. I'm for immigration. They're for legal immigration. Because if you also ask them, are you for illegal immigration? They will say no. By huge majorities, 2 out of 3, 3 out of 4, in some cases 4 out of 5. It depends upon how the question is asked. So Americans in general are for immigration, specifically legal immigration, and they're very much against illegal immigration. That's a conclusion that I've reached after much research. Now, if you continue and ask them and probe, well, how many legal immigrants should be allowed in the country every year? And you'll usually get an answer, several hundred thousand, 100,000, 200, 300, 400. You're going to get different numbers, a range of numbers, but generally it's hundreds of thousands is the units. Very few will say a million. Almost none will say 2 million. Rarely will they say 3. And when you tell them, would you like to know how many legal immigrants on average over the last 10 years have been allowed into the United States? Yeah, I'd like to know. A million? Oh, no, that can't be. You're kidding me. That must be wrong. No, it's not wrong. And why am I telling you this? The American people have not been demanding from Congress, whether it's the House or the Senate, that legal immigration, the limits, the quotas, however you want to say, need to be raised, raised, and raised. They're not. They're not doing that. If anything, they want it controlled, and they want it at a much lower level than today's maximum numbers are. We have people in the Senate and in the Congress today that want to increase it from a million to 2 million and eventually to 3 million. That is what they want to do. And it's mostly led by the Democratic Party. And this reason is not hard to understand. The Democratic Party correctly believes that if legal immigration as well as illegal immigration is increased, they will get at least 2 out of 3 of those immigrants, whether they're legal or illegal. And in some cases, depending on the country of origin, as high as 3 out of 4. So they're all for higher legal immigrants coming into the United States, as well as open borders and more illegals. They want a pathway to citizenship. They want to give legal status to those that are here illegally so they can work, because it's only a matter of time before they're on their way, a pathway to citizenship, and they ultimately get citizenship and become legal citizens and will vote Democratic. That's why the Democratic Party has made immigration the number one issue. And we have foolish people in the Republican Party that want to go along with them. I consider that political suicide. Now, this is not another show on immigration. It's a show on what do you do if neither political party reflects your views? What do you do if you identify yourself as an independent and neither candidate has your political philosophy or reflects your concerns and priorities. And remember, whoever holds that office has about a 90 to 95% probability of winning the election. That's what you're up against. And if you're still in the Republican Party but are not happy with the current incumbent, let's say you're part of the Tea Party movement, and you want to run for re-election, the Republican Party will support their incumbent. They don't want you to get on the ballot. They don't want you to win the primary, and they'll make sure by providing the incumbent more and more money. That's the problem independents are up against. So let me answer the question, what needs to be done and what do I see happening in the next 10, maybe 20 years? I think it could happen sooner than that, but let me give you my prediction. Today, depending on various polls, the major one is the Gallup's poll, somewhere between 40 and 45% of the American electorate identify themselves as independents. The Democrat number is about 35%. The Republican number is about 25%. It fluctuates. But what's the overall trend? The number of independents has gone up, up, and up, and up. It's going to bounce around month to month, year to year, but the general trend, independents, the line's going up. Republicans and Democrats are losing. Remember, we have a two-party system. The deck is stacked against third parties, and there are more than two dozen third parties. They almost never get elected. They almost never get more than 1, 2, or 3% of the vote if they're lucky. There are exceptions, but generally, third parties are not successful. So you will hear talk show hosts, and you know the names, Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levin, Hannity, Bill Bennett. If you've heard it once, you've heard it probably 1,000 times. If you vote for a third party, you're throwing your vote away, and you're really throwing your support for the opposing party. Now, I shared that conventional wisdom until I got disgusted with the Republican Party, largely over economic issues centering on fiscal responsibility. And all that means is I think the federal government should balance its budget, just like every individual, family, business, charity, educational organization, cities, counties, states have to do. I believe in fiscal responsibility. Because where you don't have fiscal responsibility, you quickly get in the situation that the U.S. federal government is in today. About the end of September, the gross debt will hit $18 trillion. That's more than the total GDP, gross domestic product, for the entire economy this year. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. If you look at what's called unfunded liabilities, and that's for Social Security, Medicare, and Obamacare, that's over $100 trillion. The United States is broke. And the debt, the interest paid on that debt, is going to get larger and larger and larger and larger. Why is that important? Early in the show, I said it's about 6% interest. In terms of the government outlays today, it's about the fifth largest category in terms of spending. And that's after defense, after welfare, and after entitlement programs such as Social Security, Medicare, and now Obamacare. So as the debt gets bigger and bigger, the interest that you have to pay gets larger and larger. And once the Federal Reserve, our central bank, can no longer manipulate interest rates and keep them arbitrarily low, and that's what they've done since December of 2008, we're going on 6 years with very arbitrarily low interest rate, where the federal funds rate, that's the rate that banks charge other banks for overnight lending, and that's typically been 3, 4, 5%. It's at 25 basis points. That's 0.25%. Rather close to zero, and that's what they call it, the near zero interest rate policy. Why are they keeping it near zero? Because you have a structure of interest rates, and that keeps the cost of the debt low. That enables the federal government to run these massive deficits that have been about a third of every dollar that the United States spends, they have to borrow it. You see, that's why I don't vote for Republicans or Democrats anymore. They're both fiscally insane. They are both weak on enforcement of our immigration laws. We've had an invasion of 30 to 50 million people over the last 15 years, and they're still coming. Until we get control of our borders, but more importantly, make it abundantly clear that we are serious about enforcing immigration laws and will deport those that are here illegally, as well as go after employers that employ these people. Until that happens, the problems are going to get worse, worse, and worse. And I was having this conversation, and I made the point, Milton Friedman has made the point, but others have made this point, including me, that up until around 1914, with a few exceptions of Asians, primarily Chinese, we had an open borders policy. If you wanted to come to the United States, provided you were not seriously ill, because they were examined at the when they entered the United States, you could come. Now, what's different between now and 1914, 100 years ago? There was no welfare state, virtually no welfare state. There was a little, but it was tiny. In other words, you either worked or you starved. Or if you couldn't make it in the United States, many people went back to wherever they came from. Just like today, out of every 3 to 5 that makes it to a sanctuary city, one goes back. Understood. That's nothing new. But the difference is you didn't have a welfare state. And that's the point I was making. I said I would be for open borders. It might surprise you. I would be for open borders. The day you eliminate the welfare state, all these welfare programs, if you have no welfare programs, fine. Because unlike 100 years ago when you didn't have welfare programs, you didn't have entitlement programs, you had to work to survive. And that benefited both the people coming and the people here. And then most Americans supported immigration, as they do today. But what is different, and why most Americans today are against illegal immigration, is that why the majority of both legal and illegal immigrants that are coming to the nation are looking for a job, a larger and larger percentage, even though they pay taxes, cost in terms of welfare, a significant amount of money. And that includes education, hospitals, as well as the long list of welfare programs. And I know some of you are going to say, well, by law, they can't get federal programs. I know what the law is. They're working here illegally. They're lying. They got fraudulent documents. They have businesses that are cooperating, for lack of a better word. They're breaking the law, because if they couldn't find the jobs here, it wouldn't be 1 out of 3 to 5 going home. It would be all of them would going home, or very few would stay. The reason they're staying is they can get the jobs and welfare. And that's the two big differences today versus 100 years ago in terms of immigration is one, and very important, and that's why I went over this in the early part of the program, is the magnitude of the numbers. We're talking 1 million legal immigrants versus an average of around 250,000 for most of that period. It's only in the 80s, 90s, and now that those numbers have gone up. And that's legal immigration. And where you have illegal immigration of between 3 and 5 million a year for the last 15 years, you begin to see the scope and size of the problem. Now, you're probably not aware of these numbers because the major media in this country, and that's the television networks, your major television networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC, will not tell you this. They stay away from this. If anything, they're for open borders, as is, for example, the Wall Street Journal, because big business, large corporations are for open borders because they want a cheap, compliant labor force. Do they care about the American workers? Do they care about the American voters? No, because they're buying politicians, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, and they buy them and they hope they stayed bought by making large campaign contributions. That's what's going on. So even there's some Republicans that in the past I have respected, and they're articulate, and I thought had integrity. Now I find out they don't. They've been bought. And that's why there probably will be a push. I don't think, and I hope not, before the August recess to get something through on immigration or something after the election. And if that doesn't work, they'll try again and again. because the Democrats are not going to give up on the issue, and neither are those who support big government in the Republican Party and want power. You know, I was saying to this gentleman I was talking to, you know, I divide people up. One way I divide them up, you have people that love liberty and you have people that love power. And the people that love liberty, they want to be left alone. That's why many of the people that came to the United States were fleeing monarchies, dictatorships, collectivist government. They were fleeing the state. They wanted religious freedom. They wanted economic opportunity. That's why they came to America. And many of them were the founding fathers. They knew what the tyranny of the state was. And that's why the Bill of Rights protects the rights of the American people and limits the government as to what it could do. Unfortunately, today, more and more, the U.S. Constitution has become a dead letter. It is the responsibility of the executive office, the president, to protect the states against invasion. They are not doing their job. And it's been Republicans and Democrats that are not doing their job. Oh, yes, there are statistics that will show you they're doing something, and it's usually at the border. But that, again, is only half the problem. It's an important piece. But the bigger piece that they don't want to talk about, they'll talk about border security, and they're playing games with, I'm for border security first. I will not vote for any comprehensive immigration reform until we secure the borders, until that is certified for many years. Sounds good, but what aren't they telling you? What aren't they telling you? What is not being enforced? Immigration law is not being enforced because it's the responsibility of the Immigration Custom Enforcement Agency to deport illegal aliens that are in sanctuary cities. They don't have the number of agents, they don't have the investigators, they don't have the attorneys, as well as the courts to do it. That's the dirty little secret. Yeah, it's important to shut down the border initially just to get some control over it. But what about the 30 to 50 million that are here? And who are they competing with? Like I said yesterday, this is the wholesale betrayal of the American people and the American worker. And it hurts everybody, but who does it mainly hurt? It hurts young workers. It hurts the unskilled. I'm not really have much sympathy for those people that have a great college education, went to a good college. They're going to get a good job. Because one of the points I was making, Germany has an excellent system where, yes, you could go to college, but if that's not for you, there are trade schools. There's an other alternative path. We have some of that in the United States, but we don't do a very good job. We need carpenters. We need air conditioner repairmen. We need mechanics. There's a long list of skills that are in short supply, and we need an educational system geared to that. We don't have that. The American people have fallen, and I call it a racket, that everyone needs a college education. No, they don't. I'll go out on a limb and say about 2 out of 3 people that are attending, for example, this junior college, A, will never get their degree, because the statistics is around a little over 20% actually complete an associate degree or a certificate. I think that's a scandal, but what is it not saying? Most of the majority of people that attend this school, as well as all these junior colleges or community colleges across the nation, they're not college material. They would be better off pursuing a career, not a college degree, a career in various trades where there's demand and they're good jobs and they're good paying jobs. That simply is not happening. And what happens? They go, for example, to this institution, which is one of the best, not only in Texas, but in the United States. And we have people here that can't read, can't write, can't communicate. And they eventually leave sooner rather than later. But they fall, you got to have a college degree. No, you don't. Yes, you need to read, you need to write, you need to communicate. But you'd be better off following another career path. So after investing your time and money, there's a job at the end of how much time you spent. We need welders, for example. We do need there's people making terrific money in the oil patch, in Montana, in Texas. There's a lot of opportunities there. It doesn't require a college education. It does require hard work. It does require application. And it does require a certain amount of training And yes, Germany has a better system. I'm just using that as an example. There are problems with Germany. But getting back to the point, what do you do when neither political party really represents your views? What I think is going to happen, ladies and gentlemen, as the number of self-identified people, when asked the question, what is your party affiliation, say independent, when that hits over 50%, what you're going to see, it might not happen for 5, 10, or maybe longer. We need it as soon as possible. That's my biggest concern. This is an urgent matter, and I wish it were tomorrow. It's not going to happen tomorrow. I would say at least 5 years to get to 50%. And that can be optimistic, even though there's been some bumping up in that number recently, which means the Democrats and Republicans are losing their base. But they have a lock. It is a very much a two-party system. But there will be a new political party that will replace one and maybe both political parties. Why? Because it's clear to me that neither political party on a host of issues that concern the American people are not being addressed. And that includes the poor growth rate of the economy, the job situation, the health insurance, where you have the Democratic Party shoving down the throats of the American people, Obamacare, dictating what the design of those plans will be when 80 to 85% of the Americans that were covered prior to that, the plans were okay. They were satisfied with them. They like to say those plans were junk. Well, talk to the... I used to sell those types of plans. The employers and their employees did not consider them junk, but they were affordable, unlike the existing plans that Obama came up with and the Democratic Party have come up. They're more expensive because there are 10 categories of required benefits that now must be included in health insurance plans. You don't think that increases the price? Oh, yes, it does. I'm a male. I don't have children. I don't need maternity. I don't need pediatric care. But they're in there if you buy one of these so-called middle plans. And if you talk to Americans that have to have already bought these individual plans, there are some that have been lower. Let me first say, I'm not going to overgeneralize, but most people have experienced significant increases in their premiums. I'm talking 50 to 100% range. And when you look at the deductibles they must pay, they're 3 to 5 times or more than their current plan that they have. And they can't keep their doctor and they can't keep their hospital. So those Americans are kind of upset about Obamacare. But what do? They can't vote for the Democratic Party. And I'm not convinced, even though they've had at least 43 votes for the repeal of it, that they're serious about it, repealing it. And it gets back to my point. If you want to win elections, if you want to get the American people behind you, public opinion behind you, you have to have a positive agenda. You have to go on the offense. You got to state, what are you for? What are your principles? What's your philosophy? But more importantly, what do you support? Why, in other words, answer the question, why should I vote for you? How are you any different than either the Democratic or Republican candidate? Because I tell you, let's say you can communicate that. I think I could communicate that. But so let's say you're a good communicator. What are you up against? An entrenched two-party system where the incumbents typically win 90 to 95% of the time. And let's say you're the opposing party. Let's say you're not an incumbent. You're up against your own political party supporting the professional politicians. That's why the leadership of the Republican Party, while they're trying to co-opt the Tea Party movement, have largely fought the Tea Party movement, even though it was a result of the Tea Party candidates winning in 2010 that John Boehner has his House speakership. Now, I say that because at some point in the not too distant future, and when you're what I'm talking about, you're talking decades typically. It's not going to happen in one election. But over time, you're going to have a successful third party challenge. There's no longer a Whig party in the United States. They were replaced by the Republican Party. Today, I see both political parties, because they're not really addressing the concerns of the American people. And I'm talking jobs. I'm talking prosperity. I'm talking about the desire to be left alone and have limited government. Definitely less than 21%, and really less than 18%, because that's the number in terms of revenues over decades that have been brought in both with high tax rates and low tax rates. It's about 18.2%. You could have balanced budgets if revenues as well as outlays or spendings in terms of GDP were about 18%. We wouldn't need to run these massive deficits. But there's nothing magic about 18%. That's high. Calvin Coolidge, when he left, it was at 3%, and that was not unusual. And he was the last president, as far as I'm concerned, that was truly concerned about government spending. I consider him a great president. Now, you better believe the progressives and liberals do not. But the reason why, one of the reasons why the 1920s were the roaring 20s was the fact that Calvin Coolidge was committed for not only balanced budgets, but to reduce the debt as well as reduce the tax rates. He did that, and we came out of one of the worst recessions, but it was a very short recession that you never heard about in 1921. And the rest is history. You see, economic policies matter, ideas matter, but ultimately where the rubber meets the road, who do I vote for? Yeah, there are people in the Republic. I'm in Texas. I support Cruz. I have some reservations, some big reservations about Cornyn. But if you look at his record, it looks like he's a solid conservative. Need to say that, but I'm a libertarian. I'm looking for results. I'm looking for limited government, and I don't see it with either party. What we have is big government conservatives. I call them bigs. Big interventionist government statists. That's definitely describes the Democratic Party, but it also describes the Republican Party, and that's somewhat sad. Calvin Coolidge was a Republican, by the way, and he could have been reelected on a landslide had he chose to run. He didn't. And that's probably, someone asked me not too long ago, well, who was a good president in the last 100 years? I said, Calvin Coolidge. Didn't have to think very long. You want a Democratic one? Grover Cleveland. That you have to go back into the 1800s, late 1800s. So there have been, in both parties, those that favor limited government, a representative republic, a constitutional government, not what we have today. And do I believe the United States economy can be changed and turned around? Yes, I do. I'm optimistic, but not when both political parties, you know, never was a fan of George Wallace, but he made the statement, there's not a dime's difference between a Democrat and a Republican. Well, I don't know about the dime, but there's not much difference when you consider just the leadership. Not what they say, what they do. And the way to describe what their priorities are. Look where they're spending the money. They are literally incapable of balancing a budget. It's only if the economy is growing will you see an increase in government revenues. And what's happening today? We are on the verge of another recession. You could be concerned about that. I hope it's going to be a short recession. We'll know in a few weeks, have a clear indication of that. We'll definitely know by the end of August. Because it doesn't matter, let's say I'm wrong and we don't have another third party for at least another 20 years. This debt bomb that I earlier outlined is going to blow up, And when that happens, what happens to the other categories, defense, welfare, entitlement program? They're going to be squeezed, as is all the other departments that are never even brought into the conversation. We can't afford the government we have today. It's way too big. It's out of hand, and it's happened under Republicans and Democrats. Don't think I'm just bashing Obama and the Democratic Party. No, I'm an equal opportunity critic, but a critic is not enough. You need to change the agenda. It's like turning an aircraft carrier. They don't turn on a dime. It's going to take time, and it's not one election. It's not one issue. So what I urge people is seriously consider the formation of a third party. Because to win elections, what do you need? You need a message. You need no momentum. You need ambition. You need someone that has fire in the belly, that wants the job. You need organization. But what you really need It's a necessary but not a sufficient condition. You need money. And you need people that are of like minds, who share a classical liberal or libertarian philosophy, namely one of limited government, significantly less than today's. I firmly can believe that we need to get under 15% and over one or two decades get under 10%. It's doable, but not with these political parties. And that is the dilemma I'm in and tens of millions of Americans are in. We don't have really a party with a slate of candidates that we can vote for. And it's deliberately and intentionally made that way. That's why both parties over time have drifted, some would say raced to the left. They've gotten further and further and further and further to the left as government has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And what has happened? We've seen the decline of the American family. We've seen illegitimacy rates sky high. We've seen, I just got the signal, got to wrap it up. And that's government gets bigger and the family is shrinking and being destroyed. So we desperately need a new political party so those independents can find a party and candidates to get behind. We need an agenda. We need principles. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk. I'm the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.